Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben, and today my guest is Dirk Jonkind. Dirk is a Senior Research Fellow in New Testament Text and Language at Tyndale House at the University of Cambridge. And we're going to be talking to Dirk today about his new edition of the Greek New Testament. It's just been published by Cambridge University Press and Crossway. Dirk, congratulations on the edition and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Before we begin talking about the edition itself, could you tell us about yourself?
Oh, well, I am a Dutchman lost in the UK. Moved here 20 years ago after a 10-year career in flower growing in the Netherlands. I came here to study to Cambridge, but never been able to get away.
And do you enjoy living in the UK?
Yeah, very much so. There's a lot of space here. There's a lot of opportunity to be yourself. And it's less crowded than the Netherlands.
Perhaps not so many cigars.
Probably, but I don't miss those.
Okay, well, let's talk about the Greek New Testament, which you have edited, and it's just been published by Crossway and Cambridge University Press. The copy that I'm looking at today is beautiful. It is a beautiful book. It's bound in French Morocco leather. It's elegantly laid out on the page. Its typography is so clear. It's a really extraordinary achievement. So congratulations.
Thank you.
What was the background to your decision to begin working this back, I think, about 2005?
Yeah, we started thinking about potentially doing a Greek New Testament here at Tyndale House, actually before I was even on staff. I had a conversation with Pete Williams, who at that time was not on staff either. And we shared the sort of kind of dreams we had and specific concerns about textual criticism, about developments that were happening, and also about kind of a philosophy of doing textual criticism, which would be perhaps not determined, but at least be informed by a strong sense of respect for history and respect for the text. So those were very early discussions. Then Pete Williams happened to become warden, now principal of Tyndale House. I became a member of staff, and we basically said, well, why don't we actually try it? So for years, I was basically working on my own. And then after 7 years, more and more people joined to push the project over the finish line. And it has been a wonderful, rich process, which ended up in working with a great team of people.
Now, as you began this project back in 2005, what were the stimuli for this? Why weren't you happy with the available editions?
Perhaps our main motivation was not so much that we were not happy with existing editions, but there was a sense in which we thought, if the work on the Greek New Testament is concentrated within one institution, within one dominant philosophy, then there is a risk to the church at large, or perhaps also neglect of responsibility, if the work is just being handed over. So there was for us a strong sense of, we want to have a confessional institution working on the text. It is good to have a text available there where the copyright is held by the church or church-related organizations themselves, and which also operates on perhaps a more down-to-earth approach to textual criticism than that which was quite popular in sort of the 1990s and beginning of the 2000s. And that was an approach that started to emphasize the role of the copyist in its editorial aspect. So the copyist became not just somebody who transported letters from one page to another page, but the copyist became a reader who was responding to the text, who was happy to change the wording of a text, was happy to change the message of the text where needed. And that line of thinking made us decisively uncomfortable, because in the end, a copyist is a copyist. And the work we had been doing on Greek manuscripts in various studies did not demonstrate that a scribe was also an editor, even though a scribe made many errors in the copying process. But it just showed, at least to me, that the scribe's intention was to copy the text, not to edit the text. And based on that sort of down-to-earth principle, we thought that it would be good to apply that principle to the whole of the Greek New Testament and see where we end up.
Now, in the Academy, we are used to using the small blue-covered edition and the red-covered edition, which come out of Germany. Within the Church, we often hear a lot of discussion about received text traditions or the Byzantine text tradition or traditions. Why did you choose to do something distinct from each of these?
When it comes to the Byzantine tradition or the received text, or in its Latin name, textus receptus, it was for us fairly easy why we would not follow the Byzantine text or the textus receptus. The textus receptus is a view on the text of the New Testament, which basically said that the text that is in print at the days of the Reformation is the text that is intended by God for the church. And therefore, the only thing we need to do is to accept the text that was there at the Reformation. I have slightly difficulties with the theology behind it, because it almost puts a level of kind of inspirational purity to the decisions and the production process that lies behind the textus receptus. And I don't see any sort of supernatural confirmation in the history of the church that would convince me or would even indicate to me that something special happened in the 16th century when it comes to the production of a Greek New Testament, which was unparalleled in the sort of 1400 years before that. So the theological argument behind the Textus Receptus is something I do not accept. Then it comes to the Byzantine text, which is basically accepting the text of the Greek Orthodox Church as it was in use during the Middle Ages. The Byzantine text shows obvious signs of textual updating. So if you compare the Gospel of Luke with the Gospel of Matthew, then quite often you see where Matthew has the full citation of the Old Testament, Luke quite often has a curtailed citation. I'm thinking here of the temptation of Jesus in the desert. Now, the Byzantine text will have added the full citation as found in Matthew to the text of Luke, so that the text reads identical, even though it is not particularly in line with how Luke deals in general with the Old Testament. So accepting the Byzantine text wholesale means accepting a text where it is obvious that, though correct in many verses, in many chapters, it is still a text that contains signs of updated and of copying errors. So that would be the reason against the Byzantine text. And that leaves us with what is perhaps an inelegant solution, that the best way of going about reproducing the original text, the text as closest as possible to the original words, is going on a variant by variant basis, where you work your way faithfully through chapter by chapter, variant by variant, and in each case, sort of try to determine to the best of our abilities, what is the original wording in this variant? How can I explain the genesis of the variant, and how can I therefore reconstruct the original text?
Now, in the introduction to the Greek New Testament, you explain that your starting point was a rather forgotten 19th century edition prepared by Samuel Predo Tregellis, whose work had influence on Westcott and Hort in 1881, and from thence on into many of the standard 20th century English language Bible translations. Who was Tregellis, and why does his work matter so much for you?
Tregellis was an interesting figure. So he was very much involved in the genesis of the Plymouth Brethren movement in the 1840s, was involved in the big split that happened between Derby and the subsequent Open Brethren. Tregellis lived in Plymouth at that time. Tregellis is someone who had a very high view of biblical inspiration. So he believed in plenary inspiration. He believed that every word of Scripture was inspired in the same way as the two tablets that Moses received out of the hand of God himself, so we were inscribed by the very finger of God. So Tregellis had a very high view of the inspiration of Scripture. And that was for him the reason to put all his effort in finding what those words actually are, because every word matters. And it is that sort of attitude which I think is a very good, a very Christian motivation for doing textual criticism. And why we started with Tregellis is that we know that in the Christian church, there there are areas where people are suspicious of doing this work. Now, how can people determine what the word of God is? And in order to allay some of those fears and some of that uncertainty, perhaps even criticism, we thought, well, let's start with a source where most people won't have any objections to. Now, Tregellis is in that sense an orthodox starting point for doing textual criticism of the New Testament. The other advantage is Tregellis was the first Anglo-Saxon who produced a critical Greek New Testament. So in that sense, he stands at the beginning of a long tradition of scholarship. And as you said, Westcott and Hort were in close contact with Tregellis. Actually, Tregellis died before his final installment of his work, Book of Revelation, was seen through press, and Hort took it upon himself to make sure that Tregellis's edition was completed. And if you read some of the letters of consolation that Hort wrote to the widow of Tregellis, there's a deep sense of respect between them.
Fascinating. Well, as you began with Tregellis, you and the editorial team very quickly decided to do a more radical revision of Tregellis than you might first have anticipated. And so you've had to think quite carefully about your own canons of textual criticism. How did you approach that question? You tell us in the introduction that to ensure your work is as early as possible, you insist that every text be attested by two or more sources. Is that an unusual procedure in New Testament text criticism?
I think this particular rule is not so much a canon, but it was a constant reminder that it is easy to get carried away by one's own brilliant theories and one's own very astute lines of reasoning, etc. And if there's one thing I am reasonably convinced about, is that we all need checks and balances, because our mind can run circles around the best intentions we have. So we kept that as a rule of thumb, that every reading is normally by two manuscripts, and one of them is from before the 5th century. I am not absolutely sure if in each and every case we have followed that rule. I think we have. But there may have been one or two cases where the actual reason not to print the earliest attested text was very strong. But another way of summarizing this rule is we keep on asking ourselves, do we have a good reason not to print the earliest attested text? Sometimes there can be a very good reason, but it is not the case that we expect that the original text has been preserved only in manuscripts from the year 1300 or 1400 or 1500. There is a sense that though it is possible that later manuscripts contain the original wording over against early manuscripts, so it is possible, it is more likely that the earlier manuscripts are more likely to contain the original wording. So that is roughly the balance when it comes to external evidence. So external evidence, the evidence provided by manuscripts. But then, quite often, we will have a variant unit in which the two or three alternatives are all attested by equally ancient witnesses. What do we do in those cases? we need some extra help. And our rule of thumb was basically this. Can we explain the variance as a result of things that tend to go wrong in the normal process of copying? So can we explain the variance as accidental errors? Now, accidental errors can be very complicated simply because copying is a cognitive process. And we have learned sufficient about cognitive processes from psychology and linguistics and all that, that we know that things can go wrong in very complicated ways. But as soon as we have a scribal copying explanation for a variant, that is sufficient for us because it is most likely that a variant does not come into existence because the scribe wanted to make a change, but simply as a result of things that can go wrong when you copy.
So how did you apply those principles to famous, controversially difficult passages like the ending of Mark, or perhaps the pericope about the woman caught in adultery in John chapter 8?
Now, editing a Greek New Testament is most of the time working with very minute variants. You mentioned some of the very big ones, and the big ones have been known for many centuries. But many of the small variants, they provide the majority of the work you have to do as an editor. So you will find the results of our approach most starkly in all the tiny variants throughout. And collectively, they make sort of a good difference between the Tyndale House text and other texts. When it comes to those very big variants, there we are in special territory. So I don't think we have brought to bear many new arguments when it comes to the story of the woman caught in adultery in John 8, or to the ending of Mark. When it comes to the ending of Mark, we refrained from putting brackets around the long ending of Mark or relegating it to footnote. What we did in the case of Mark 16 is to put a little note in the main text that translates as, now in some of the most ancient manuscripts, the gospel finishes here, but in many others also the following is contained. And then we follow with the long ending of Mark. And that is because in the end, there are only two Greek manuscripts that omit the long ending. Hmm. So in that sense, when you look at kind of the whole of the manuscript tradition, yes, to exclude that passage on the basis of two manuscripts, you must have good arguments. I think there are very strong arguments against the long ending of Mark. I mean, not the least because in the early 4th centuries, the church was debating this issue already. Hmm. So it's one of the oldest known textual variants and goes back a very long time. But still, the external evidence is not decisive or overwhelming on its own. When it comes to the story of the woman caught in adultery, the external evidence is much clearer there. It is not found in most of the manuscripts from before the 7th, 8th century, and then it starts to be found quite rapidly, almost universally, but always with some exceptions in the medieval Greek manuscript, that there are places that leave it out. So there the external evidence is much clearer. And that is why we put the story of the woman caught in adultery in the footnote, because as far as I can see, it is not part of what the of what John originally wrote in his gospel. Now, he finishes his gospel, of course, with that sort of intriguing remark, saying that there are many other things that Jesus has done. If all of them were written down, the world would not be able to contain all the books. Whether or not that was an invitation to actually add this story to the gospel, because it was almost a gospel, or was almost a story in search for a hope. Whether or not that was the reason, I'm not completely sure. But the story in itself is clearly old. The story rings very much true, or the resonates very strongly with how you get to know Jesus from the regular Gospels. So for me, the question whether or not something is historical or whether or not it is part of John's Gospel are two different questions. Now, I can answer the question quite confidently. It was not part of John's Gospel from the beginning, not for the first centuries or so. Whether or not it is historical or not, that is a completely different question.
Of course.
I am not as clear on that one.
Well, Dirk, you've mentioned a couple of really big text critical difficulties there, John 8, Mark 16. But one of the charming aspects of your edition is the way in which it focuses upon very small textual differences, including differences of spelling. Could you talk us through how you thought about this issue and why you decided to allow for variation in spelling?
Yes, there are a couple of reasons why we paid attention to spelling, but also why we allowed inconsistencies there. And the first thing is this: everyone who has worked with manuscripts knows that our notion of consistency is not shared in textual tradition. So there is a sense in which we prize consistency higher than the era from which most of our evidence comes. So that was for me a timely reminder that to impose consistency may be the same as to impose our modern norms on things that come from us from antiquity. I think that is always a good thing to be reminded of. But then spelling issues can actually make a real difference. And it is not a big difference, but it is a difference in the way things are packaged. And one of my favorite examples is found in 1 Corinthians 6, where Paul has just given a whole vice list adulterers, thieves, drunkards, etc. And then he continues in 1 Corinthians 6:11, and you were these things. So you were those thieves, etc. And then he continues with, but you have been washed, but you have been sanctified, but you have been justified. Now, this is a literal translation, and the Greek has indeed that repeated word but three times. Now, the word but in Greek can be written in two ways, as alla, two syllables, or just one syllable, al. And then the final alpha is sort of dropped. And the final alpha is dropped when the next word starts with a vowel. At least that is the rule that we thought was there. Greek manuscripts don't know that rule as such. I mean, quite often they follow it, but there are also passages where they blatantly ignore it. And this is one of the examples where not just one manuscript, but many manuscripts, ignore the rule. So they write the full two-syllable and properly accented Allah before, but you have been washed, but you have been sanctified, but you have been justified. And each of the three verbs starts with a vowel. By having the full length Allah rather than the shortened form, it gets a little bit more oomph, the word. Even when you sort of translate it in English, the repeated word but draws some focus on it by its repetition. And that is, in the Greek spelling, indicated by going against the rule and just write out the word in full. Now, does it make a difference in your exegesis of this particular verse? Not really, but it is still part of the packaging, and it is still part of how you give more focus to particular words. So that is one of the examples where I could understand the difference. But what about all those examples where I don't understand the difference? Then the question is, should I, as an editor, present a text that is limited by my understanding, or should I provide the best possible reconstruction of the oldest evidence we can find? And for me, it is clearly the latter. So the text, also in its spelling peculiarities, should not be limited by my understanding, but it should help others to ask questions that nobody asked before. And that is the sort of worth of making a new edition.
Hmm. Now, there's a lot of fun in the way you approach the spelling issue, isn't there? But perhaps one of the most striking differences between this edition and the other editions that are available is your decision to reorganize the order of the canon. What did you decide to do, and why did you decide to do it?
Well, I think even the shape of your question sort of is a bias, isn't it? Well, first of all, the question was asked basically by Tregellis already. So Tregellis has, after Acts, now the Catholic epistles, so James, Peter, John, and Jude. And then after Jude, continues with Romans. So that's Tregellis in the 1850s. Westcott and Hort took over that same order. So Westcott and Hort also have the order as we have it in the Tyndale House edition. And it is actually the order that became standard in sort of Greek manuscripts. Very early on, we don't have manuscripts that contain a variety of books. So from the 4th century, we get our first complete Greek New Testaments. And there the order is certainly not consistent at all. But later on, we see that Acts is always combined with the Catholic epistles. So from Acts, you get you move to James. I am not sure if it means something, but because we wanted to reflect the Greek tradition, we thought we'll stick with the Greek order of books. What we have in our English translation is not the Greek, but the Latin order of books. So when the Greek New Testament became a printed book in the 16th century, the Greek functioned mainly to correct the Latin, because that was the Bible of choice. And in that process, the order of the Latin books was maintained rather than the order of the Greek books. Again, I don't want to limit the edition by my understanding. It may mean something, it may not mean anything, but there is something elegant about having the Catholic epistles immediately after Acts, because the first half of Acts deals with James and Peter and John, and the second half of Acts with Paul. Mm. And perhaps that order is reflected in the way how the letters follow.
Mm. That's a fascinating observation. As you think about the edition as a whole, in terms of orthography, canonical order, text critical canons, etc., what kind of impact do you hope it will make in scholarship and perhaps even in the church?
I hope that the biggest impact will be on the church, frankly. Our hope with this edition was that we wanted not so much produce a critical edition of the Greek New Testament. I mean, it is a critical edition, but that's not sort of our primary goal. Our primary goal was to produce a Greek New Testament that feels and functions like a Bible rather than a critical edition. Mm. So therefore, I hope that the edition very much feels like a Bible. That is why we have Bible publishers. It is something that I hope that people will read, not so much in order to become aware of all sorts of textual variants, but because they want to interact with the text, because they want to read the New Testament in Greek. So our main goal was not so much to produce a tool for textual criticism, as well as a very good text that can be used to study the New Testament. At the same time, by doing what we are doing, we are raising questions. And I expect that for years to come, some of those questions will play a role in discussions about the role of the editor, in discussions about paragraphing, about structuring the text, about the canons of textual criticism, what sort of rules do we use to decide between variants. And I think in all those areas, we make substantial contributions.
Well, Dirk, it's a fascinating project. It's a huge step forward in presenting us with a New Testament that looks and feels genuinely antique. And it's really striking to see the differences between this edition and lots of the other editions that are available today. This feels so much more authentic in a way and than some others. Before we wind up, could you tell us a little bit about what you're working on at the moment? I've read some work by you recently about Tregellis. You've got a book forthcoming with Crossway as an introduction to this edition. What else is going on in your scholarly world at the moment?
My main project is, together with a colleague, a postdoc, Elijah Hickson, we are writing an explanation of the textual choices we have made. Hmm. So it functions a little bit like a textual commentary on a selection of variants. Many people may know the textual commentary on the Greek New Testament that was produced by Bruce Metzger. Mm-hmm. Well, in 2 years' time, that textual commentary will be half a century old. Mm. And we thought, as a matter of scholarly accountability, we will produce this textual commentary so that people will actually know why we did what we have done. And because we made good notes during the whole process of preparing the Tyndale House edition, we hope to have it published within a matter of 2 years, perhaps three at the most. But we are already in Luke, not having started Matthew. So we're making good progress.
That sounds great. That sounds like a really useful project. In the meantime, Dirk, thanks very much for sharing your work with us today, for coming on to the show and talking about this new edition of the Greek New Testament, just published by Cambridge University Press and Crossway. And thanks for coming on to the show to talk about it. Thanks for your time and take care.
It's absolutely the thing I love doing best. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. And thanks to everyone else for listening in today. I'll see you next time on New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. Thank you.